coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Protests over the past 2 weeks in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in police custody are bringing increased scrutiny to law enforcement practices and policies in Delaware.
And if an officer steps out of line, does something wrong, actually looking at a situation from a fair perspective and then making a suggestion on how the officer should be handled.
Our Sophia Schmidt joins us to look at the issues and possible solutions here in the First State. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine how retailers are navigating reopening after the COVID-19 shutdown and learn more about the state's efforts to prepare for a possible coronavirus resurgence. Plus, Arts Playlist tells us how the Milton Theater is working to reconnect with its audience now that it's reopened. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Protests over the past 2 weeks in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis are bringing new scrutiny to law enforcement practices and policies around the country, including here in Delaware. And that scrutiny is already leading to some proposals from state and local lawmakers to make changes. And as we look at these proposals and what protesters are asking for, we see some common concerns and issues raised. Over the past week, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt spent time reporting on some of these issues and concerns. You can find her coverage at DelawarePublic.org, and she joined me earlier this week to discuss what she found. Sophia, I wanted to start out by just pointing out to our audience that many of these issues and proposals you looked at over the past week are not new. They're just getting new attention in light of the killing of George Floyd and the protests that sparked it, correct?
Yeah, for sure. So, there are groups and individuals who have been speaking out against police brutality, especially toward Black and brown people, and the policies and practices that they say allow it to continue happening for years and years, and, including in Delaware specifically. And we've also seen already, efforts by lawmakers, whether that's on the local level or the state level, and the attorney general to try to reform some of this stuff. But right now, I think it's fair to say that anyone who's ever pushed for some kind of policing reform is ramping up their calls again because, the elected officials and lawmakers say that they're listening. There is just this kind of feeling of intense urgency right now.
So let's go through some of these things that you covered one by one, and let's start with the one that you covered actually on last week's edition of The Green, and that was use of force policies. Just remind us again, where does Delaware stand on this issue compared to other states?
So use of force statutes are basically justifications under state code that allow you to defend yourself if you're sued for using force. So these protect you from criminal liability. And Delaware has several ones available to civilians as well, and that's use of force in self-protection. Another one specific to law enforcement, which says an officer is justified in using force under a number of situations, including if it's necessary to make an arrest. And then there's a higher bar for deadly force. So what I heard from a professor at Widener University, Delaware Law School, Judith Ritter, she said Delaware statute is actually very similar to those of a lot of other states. That's because ours is basically the same as the model penal code. But where it differs from some other states is in what happens to the officer's defense if a jury finds that his or her belief that they had to use force was not reasonable. So in some other states, that completely invalidates the whole defense. And in Delaware, it's a little bit more lenient toward the defendant, which in this case would be like a police officer. And it means that they might get something like negligent homicide instead of murder if it's a case where the use of force resulted in death.
Is there any consensus on what can be a path forward to change in this area?
Right now, I think you could say there's a pretty wide agreement among groups like NAACP, ACLU, other advocates, and even lawmakers and elected officials that like these laws are an issue to police accountability. Leaders in the NAACP and, some of these are like folks who've fought in the civil rights arena for so many years. They pointed me to the case of Jeremy McDowell, who was, this is a pretty, famous case in Delaware, a wheelchair user. He was shot and killed by four Wilmington police officers in 2015. And, it was caught on camera. It's a really disturbing video. And there was a ton of outrage among citizens. There still is. and the Attorney General's office investigated, as they do, the use of deadly force in this case, and found a bunch of issues from like training, Wilmington Police Department policy, and the conduct of especially one officer in particular, and the way he approached the scene. But DOJ could not charge any of these officers because their actions were justified under state code. And since then, DOJ has investigated, you know, a number of other cases of deadly force use, and found them all to be justified under state code. So advocates say, you know, that's just ridiculous. And the NAACP is actually calling for a complete repeal of these statutes. Now, the state attorney general released a set of reform proposals Wednesday, and she wants to make it so that when, you know, an officer is using this statute to defend themselves for using force, that the belief that force was necessary has to be objectively reasonable. And she says that the current statute is subjective, and it doesn't require a police officer to establish that the use of force was actually necessary.
Another area you looked at that's considered by many an impediment to dealing with police conduct, especially in the use of force, is the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. Can you give us kind of a quick sketch of Delaware's version of it and how it kind of fits into this whole process?
It's kind of interesting. It's another section of state code. This one governs how police can be investigated internally for misconduct, so within the department. Delaware is one of 14 states, about 14 states that have these, according to one expert I talked to, and ours dates back to 1985. And it lays out ground rules for how the interrogations of cops can happen. So it requires that, like, questioning of police officers be done at a reasonable hour for a reasonable amount of time, preferably during their scheduled shift, stuff like that. And the big thing that people also point to is it also keeps all the records of these investigations and, you know, citizen complaints against cops hidden from the public. So according to Camille Boynton, who's a professor at DSU I talked to, Delaware's Bill of Rights here has one of the strongest provisions for the privacy of the records out of the other states that use these as well.
And so what are calls for change on this look like? What are some of the people you talk to advocating to kind of make this work better and be, I think, the bigger issue, more transparent?
Yeah. So to start, I talked with the NAACP of Delaware. And again, they, you know, are basically opposed to this entire statute. They argue that it conflicts, like the parts about privacy of the records, that it conflicts with the state's Freedom of Information Act and that it should be repealed. The Legislative Black Caucus, who unveiled an agenda Wednesday, they are looking to amend the statute to allow criminal defendants' legal counsel to access these internal investigation records. And then the state attorney general, Kathy Jennings, has also proposed a change to this. She wants to focus on the transparency aspect that we mentioned, as she puts it, ensuring investigations are unimpeded, and also requiring that drug and alcohol testing happens following a use of force incident.
Another fairly common area for calls for reform at this juncture is creation of civilian review boards to look into police misconduct. Tell us a little bit about, from your reporting, what that would look like and what that would do to kind of address some of these other issues.
These civilian review boards, community review boards, sometimes called different things, these are in place in cities across the country, and there's sort of different models that they can follow. I spoke with Mike Brickner, who's the new director of the ACLU of Delaware, and he said to me that the devil's really in the details in these kind of bodies, because it really depends, like, how much power does this body actually have to dictate what kind of discipline happens in the case of police misconduct. Do they, you know, what kind of records or data do they have access to? How are the members appointed is a big thing. So one group in Delaware called Delaware for Police Oversight has been advocating for a civilian statewide community review board for at least a year. They've re-upped their calls, you know, in light of the protests. And they want to see, like I mentioned, statewide review board. One important thing to them is that the members of this review board are primarily private citizens, are primarily from the communities that often see over-policing and that are the most impacted by police violence. And they also want to make sure that the members are paid a stipend for participating in this. Again, they say that the people who are most often impacted by police violence are low-income individuals. So that would help, you know, make sure that we really do get the right kind of representation on this board that they're looking for. And they also want that board to have access to, you know, data, access to basically the things that we mentioned in the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, the record of, you know, investigations into misconduct. They would also be a body that looks at policy and can make recommendations in that regard. And then there's one last part that Depot, as they call themselves, are looking for this board to do, which would be look into alternatives to police presence in communities. And the Attorney General, Wednesday, she put out this list of different reforms that she's looking for. That includes establishment of a statewide civilian review board to provide independent review of police misconduct cases. And kind of separately, but on a similar topic, she wants to expand the Division of Civil Rights and Public Trust, which is in Department of Justice, their authority to review the use of force incidents beyond fatal police shootings. The Legislative Black Caucus wants to form kind of a different body that's a law enforcement accountability task force, which would include police as well as citizens. And that would more so be the side looking into, you know, more policy and reform issues.
What are some of the other things we're hearing about? I mean, I know one of them is body cams, especially in Wilmington. Where does that stand in terms of moving forward?
So, you know, again, body cameras, just like these other things, it's not really like a new and radical solution. This is something that's in place in a lot of places. In Delaware, a couple police forces still don't have these. And this is, you know, Wilmington doesn't. Delaware State Police does not. Newcastle County has had them deployed since 2016, and a few other agencies have them as well. In the case of Wilmington, so Wilmington piloted body cameras in 2016. And since then, leadership, you know, they say that they want them, but there just continues to sort of be hurdles to rolling them out. A big one has been funding. And so last year, the city said that they wanted to try to fund this in part through federal grants. The police department applied for one. They did not receive it. And so that kind of slowed things down. City council, some members said, let's just fund the whole thing through the budget. That did not really make progress. And the budget for next fiscal year actually passed a couple weeks ago, did not include any funding for body cameras, which some citizens and council members were upset about. But it ultimately didn't hold up the budget passing. And again, the police department have applied for this federal grant that would fund part of the program. The latest development is that Mayor Mike Przycki and City Council President Hanifa Shabazz last Friday, just, you know, a half hour before the big protest in Wilmington was planned to start, they put out a statement committing to, you know, ensuring that these body cams get out to officers, you know, as soon as possible. The mayor said that he was committing to finding $800,000 match to this federal grant if the police get it, and then, you know, committing to finding additional funding if the police department does not receive this grant. And I reached out asking, you know, where in the budget this money would come from, because you know, just like all municipal budgets right now, getting hit really hard by the pandemic and the recession, they had to kind of go back to the drawing board and cut a bunch of things from the budget to balance it without a tax increase. And so I know, you know, there's not a ton of extra money floating around here. I did not get an answer as to where that money's going to come from. So I guess, you know, remains to be seen what happens there. But there has been, it's been a constant conversation in Wilmington. When are we going to get these body cameras?
And I do think it's important for us to point out, you mentioned the funding hurdle, particularly when it comes in terms of body cams. But for a lot of these other things that we're talking about, another hurdle is police contracts. I mean, that there are union contracts. And to make any of these changes, there's likely going to have to be some kind of work with local unions, correct?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, across the country, I mean, the police unions are kind of notorious as the place where a lot of this reform can get held up. And actually, we saw in the issue with funding the body cameras, one of the delays that happened during the past year in Wilmington was the fact that the Wilmington Police Union wanted to negotiate the disciplinary aspect of how these body cams would be used in their contract. I tried to speak with more local level police unions this week doing this reporting. I was directed to the state level. So I spoke with Fred Calhoun, who is the president of the statewide FOP, about some of these reforms that are being proposed. And he, opposes the civilian review board idea. Basically, he argues like these, civilians are not law enforcement experts. How would, any of us feel having non-experts in our field sort of making decisions about the way that we should operate? The second thing is I spoke with him about the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, and he, defended these protections, again, saying that public opinion right now is, there's a lot of feelings ranging from skepticism to, complete distrust and dislike of, police in general right now in the public opinion. And he says that if, there was more transparency about complaints made against us, even if we're found innocent of those complaints, cleared of them, they can still be held against us by the public. So that's why we need this, privacy.
One other thing I did want to touch on here briefly is something that's been getting attention elsewhere nationally, and that's this push to defund the police. It doesn't seem like it's being brought up much here, but first let's just kind of frame for people what it is. It's a little bit more nuanced than the phrase itself might suggest.
Yeah, so most advocates for defunding the police, it's not that they necessarily want the police to have no funding whatsoever, but it's this idea that, right now the police serve kind of a broad role. They deal with all kinds of issues, and advocates would say that some of those things, like maybe dealing with people who are going through a mental health crisis, whether it's, a homelessness issue or even domestic violence, that sometimes those issues would actually be better dealt with by, a mental health expert, someone who works on rehousing people who are homeless, and that maybe kind of the role of police can be shrunk and some of that money can be actually diverted elsewhere, whether that's to education, some of these, kind of strengthening communities, even just boosting, the economic stability of an area can, advocates would argue that would actually reduce crime. So kind of re-envisioning public safety, I guess.
Have we heard from any advocates locally that are kind of trying to get this into the conversation?
It's not something that we're hearing a ton locally. I saw like one or two signs, at the protest in Wilmington Friday that pointed to this desire to defund police. I did speak briefly today with Medina Wilson Anton, who's a candidate for state rep right now, and she is has been one of the organizers of the big protest in Wilmington last Friday. She says that she is for, in her words, demilitarization of the police, defunding and investing in alternatives. So it's something that people are considering. People are kind of thinking about. We're not just hearing the phrase defund the police like thrown around too much here yet.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt for her time and reporting this week. You can read her coverage of what could be next for law enforcement practices and policies in Delaware at delawarepublic.org. And next on The Green, as Delaware moves to phase two of its reopening plan, we take a look at the retail landscape as it begins efforts to bounce back from the COVID-19 shutdown. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware moves from Phase 1 to Phase 2 of its reopening plan this Monday, June 15th. Phase 1 allowed many stores the chance to open their doors again, albeit with limited capacity. Phase 2 allows even more things to open up, and those already operating some additional capacity, up to 60%. So how are stores faring in this launch of a new normal? We turn to contributor Eileen Dalabrita this week to get the lay of the land. Her piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and she joined me earlier this week to discuss it. So as we've noted in previous reporting, reopening doesn't mean the light switch is flipped on and everybody comes back all at once. It truly seems to be a situation that it's different strokes for different folks. And that's the same in retail, correct?
It is. Different stores have different strategies as to how many folks that are going to be allowed in that are well under the prescribed, it will be 60% soon, but now it's much less than that, 30%. And because they want to give people one-on-one contact or because they're just not anticipating that many shoppers. So the stores that are nimble and have attractive inventory have a decided advantage in opening quickly. And it's also a situation where the independent boutiques might have an edge because there are fewer layers of management and bureaucracy to cut through in getting those businesses up and running.
So as those stores start to reopen, how are shoppers reacting at this juncture? Is there any sense if they're ready to come back? And if they are, what are they eager to buy at this point?
Well, shoppers have become accustomed to buying necessities. So I expect those kinds of goods will be most popular. The kids have outgrown their shoes, that sort of thing. And it will take a while before shopping becomes a pleasure and consumers don't feel that they're putting themselves at risk to browse.
So what are retailers doing to get people to come through their doors? Are there ways that they can maybe make people feel like it's a good idea to get out and about?
Yeah, they're pulling out all the stops to entice people to come back. They're sending email blasts to existing customers and using social media to reach out to new customers. And they're also implementing effective old school strategies such as great big signs that say, we're open.
And I guess that's something that maybe people wouldn't think of right away, that people may not know who is or isn't open. And something as simple as signage saying, hey, we're here, is really something that you do kind of have to do at this point.
It's very important, especially to get that drive-by traffic since people are starting to actually get behind the wheel a little more.
You've spent some time previously reporting on malls pre-pandemic. How are they reopening, and what's the landscape for places like Christiana Mall, Dover Mall, and even places like the outlets in Rehoboth?
Well, the malls, Dover, Christiana, and Concord, are all operating, as are the popular Tanger outlets in Rehoboth. But they're not yet the shopping centers we were accustomed to before the pandemic. Management is encouraging people to check the mall or outlet website to ensure that the store that they want to patronize is indeed open. It's, you know, plexiglass at the counter, masks for everyone. They're at the outlets, they're handing out bottled water and hand sanitizer, the new normal.
And I imagine for places like that, it may be some time before you see everything that was previously open again at those type of locations?
At Christiana, about 60% of stores are open. At the outlets, it's 50%. It's going to take some time. And as we already know, not everybody will be coming back.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But let's talk first about the stores in Wilmington, especially the ones along Market Street where recent protests and initially some looting associated with them have added kind of another layer to deal with on top of bouncing back from the pandemic shutdown. How are they faring and what are their strategies?
Well, the looting made a bad situation even worse. And even though most of the impacted retailers were covered by insurance, for the goods that were trashed or stolen, they lose out on opportunity. The people who would have come to their stores or dined at their restaurants had those venues not had to close for repairs. It also adds another layer to the issue of safety. Prospective shoppers who already are afraid of COVID-19 might also be wary of shopping in a district where they may be fearful of crime.
You also report that there are some trends developing in the wake of this shutdown, some things maybe that we didn't see before but are seeing now. One of those would be the emergence of curbside pickup. Let's start with that. Are stores going to stick with curbside pickup? Is that a thing now?
Well, curbside orders leapt 208% during the pandemic, and curbside pickup will be with us long after the pandemic ends. Many stores have already offered buy online pickup in store locations, and curbside takes it up a notch. customers say they appreciate the safety and convenience, and 59% of them say that they want to continue curbside pickup after the pandemic ends. And as for the merchants, because they have established these curbside pickup procedures and work through the logistics, it's easy for them to maintain the practice.
Is that a situation where maybe before curbside pickup was more of a larger store thing, and now even smaller stores are kind of getting in on this game?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I bought paint from a small Sherwin-Williams store the other day with curbside pickup. I called. I told them what color I wanted and what supplies I wanted to buy, and drove to the store, and a nice young lady wearing gloves and a mask came out and put my stuff on the curb.
Are there some other things we're seeing that are kind of emerging as trends post-COVID-19 shutdown?
Yeah, one of the things that we're going to see is automation really zooming to limit human exposure. It's more efficient for a robot to fulfill orders than a human employee who has to observe social distancing. Robots don't get sick. They don't make other people sick. And big retailers like Amazon and Walmart are using more robots to track and clean inventory. And we expect many smaller stores will follow suit. We'll also see more people looking for touchless and automated options, including ordering by kiosk and a further uptick in self-checkout. We're also seeing really deep discounts from retailers like American Eagle, who are marking down as much as 60% in order to get goods out the door. In contrast, Gap is packing away a lot of inventory rather than take a hit on it. Staples like jeans and t-shirts, which won't look tragically out of fashion when they bring it out next spring. We're also seeing retailers that sell business attire experience a sharp downturn as people work from home in yoga pants instead of putting on a blazer and tie. There are no dress-up events like weddings and funerals. So we're seeing Men's Warehouse and Joseph A. Banks truly suffering. And the iconic Brooks Brothers is reportedly exploring bankruptcy.
It is definitely a new normal in a lot of ways, in a lot of ways that people really maybe never even considered. We have talked previously, and you alluded to earlier, whether some stores were going to survive this whole shutdown. Is there any sense on how many just aren't going to make it back? Or is there maybe a little bit more optimism now than there was a few weeks ago about retail coming back and some stores that might have been on the brink hanging in there?
I do sense that consumers and merchants are feeling more upbeat. Macy's had forecast it would regain about 20% of its business, and they're actually realizing about 50%, way better than expected. We also know that some stores just weren't able to hang on, and at Christiana Mall, True Religion and Wilson's Leather are closing. Other stores are in the decision-making process. And J.W. Dawson, a big sit-down restaurant, also will not reopen.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time this week. You can read her reporting on retailers reopening after the coronavirus pandemic shutdown at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Even as the first state reopens, concerns linger about a resurgence of COVID-19 later this year. How is the state preparing for that possibility? We'll examine that next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. An executive order from Governor John Carney earlier this month created a working group meant to prepare Delaware for a possible resurgence of COVID-19 cases in the fall. The Pandemic Resurgence Advisory Committee meets for the first time this week, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino recently spoke with one of the group's co-chairs, Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long.
Can you go over some of the priorities heading into this first meeting?
Well, Nick, after this past year's experience, the governor wanted to make sure that the state was in the best position should there be a resurgence this fall. And he had delineated three goals, right? And they are pretty straightforward. One, let's make sure our healthcare system is ready and prepared, and let's have a strategy for public health. And then let's also make sure, too, that you've got the resources in place and that, you know, if there is this resurgence, we have in place those PPE measures, that we have a campaign that's necessary for social distancing, that we've got an economic recovery readiness, right, that we're ready. And then the third bucket, basically, because it goes along with our committee structure, is making sure that vulnerable populations have equitable outcomes and have not the disproportionate effects that we have seen, particularly among communities of color where there has been an impact. So again, Executive 39, an order really leads the PRAC, and our whole structure is focused around those three major goals.
And then it's the group's role to give written reports to the governor following its conclusions, correct?
Absolutely, yes. It's and not only just our groups and the subgroups, which again are those three buckets, the economics, the health, and the equity group buckets, but they are comprised of 46 individuals who have vast experience and insight from our period of time from March until now. And also they are going to have the opportunity as we issue those reports to make sure our public is involved and engaged. Because again, you know, any report we put forth, there will be an interim report by the end of July, ideally, and also a final report sometime in September. Certainly, it's a movable, breathing document. You know, we are taking this day by day, and we will have to have the buy-in with the community and the public.
To your mind, from the public health aspect, the state has worked hard to increase its both its testing capacity, trying to ramp up its contact tracing program and make sure there's PPE available in clinical settings. What, to your mind, needs to happen that isn't already happening?
What you're looking at now, what you're talking about is, you know, those resource measures, right? Making sure we have them and having that health system, right? Our hospitals have stepped up, our nonprofits have stepped up, and we want to make sure that if and when, and I am saying as a public health nurse with Secretary Bullock, who is my co-chair, and he and I both want an open, transparent process to make sure not only that those resources of PPE and a plan with public health and our hospital systems are in place, but making sure that not one single Delawarean who needed access to those services or who needed food who was home in isolation or needed mental health service during this time gets it. Our goal is what we're seeing now. Our goal is a flattening of the curve. And our goal is to keep people out of the hospital, off of ventilators, and ultimately saving Delawareans' lives in our most at-risk groups, particularly communities of color, as we saw in Sussex with our Latino population, our minority population, and also our real vulnerable, our homeless and our nursing home residents.
In respect to shutting down parts of Delaware's economy, if there is a resurgence of the virus, will the group be strategizing different ways to maybe avoid shutdowns and allow businesses to continue if the businesses are taking measures to reduce the spread and sort of, I guess you could say, live with the virus rather than shutting down the entire economy?
Yes, and that is exactly our goal. What you just said is spot on. Ability for us to remain open if we have a resurgence and avoid those broad shutdowns is a priority. But doing it safely and keeping our children safe, our seniors, those with health compromises, safe.
So this is not the first advisory group that you've run on behalf of the governor. I'm referring to the Behavioral Health Consortium. Can you outline, if you can, how the pandemic has affected the efforts of that group and how maybe you're looking to resume combating the state's opioid crisis now that things are starting to open back up?
We have actually continued during this crisis. The Department of Substance Abuse and Mental Health and many of the awesome nonprofits in our state have continued to work with us, with first responders, our hospital systems, our police and others in the community, as we've been dealing with a real increase in mental health and substance use issues. As you mentioned, the Behavioral Health Consortium has continued its work. What we say at the BHC is that we are fighting an epidemic during a pandemic. Our numbers of overdose deaths have risen 30% during this time, and our suicide hotline calls have increased, I'm told, almost 50%. And it has been real challenging. It's been challenging for our persons in social isolation. And a shout out to our frontline health workers, our doctors, our nurses, our individuals manning and working in our grocery stores, our bus drivers. All of them have had increased anxiety and stress. And so we're really working to make sure that people get resources, you know, and our resources are spread thin. So Department of Substance Abuse and Mental Health has created a hope line where people get individual texts. We're encouraging folks to call 211. Myself and Dr. Gibney and others who are part of the Behavioral Health Consortium's Access and Treatment Committee, we have been out on the streets. Not only has she done COVID screening, but also handing out naloxone in our high-risk community and providing mental health services. So that has continued. I don't know what our numbers would be if we had not had a plan like the Behavioral Health Consortium. Our numbers would be even higher than they are with the overdose death rate. So I'm thankful to great community players and volunteers who serve on that Behavioral Health Consortium.
Can you speak as well to surge capacity with the initial outbreak? The state kind of scrambled to set up field hospitals in preparation of a surge beyond what hospitals could hold. But ultimately, those field hospitals were not ever used. Can you speak to, I guess, being prepared for a surge that might exceed hospitals without investing time and effort in setting up facilities that don't get used?
You know, again, that is, you know, we unfortunately don't have that crystal ball for the fall. And that's why it's so important that we have this pandemic resurgence advisory committee, where we do have that health bucket with experts. We know in order to have a healthy economy, you got to have a healthy community. And having capacity and backup plans are critical. Our Office of Emergency Planning and Operations in the Division of Public Health, led through Dr. Carol Rattay, as well as DEMA's leader, A.J. Shaw, will be part of the Pandemic Resurgence Committee. And there are operational plans every day in the state of Delaware for disasters in place. This particular pandemic was more stressful. And to our hospital partners' credit and our federal partners, our local partners and county, we were able to put in place backup surge capacity hospitals or plans for overflow in facilities. Thank goodness our hospitals never reach max capacity, nor do we run out of ventilators and critical care unit. I want to make it clear to the public that because we're back in our community does not mean we are completely safe for winter and fall. It is so important. You must social distance. We must wear our masks. We must do these things. We do not, and again, I want to emphasize, do not have a treatment and we do not have a vaccination. And so having the PRAC and the plan in place is only as good as Delawareans and the visitors to our states and the wonderful business community participates and follows these protection guidelines. As a public health nursing professor in my other hat, I can tell you teaching infectious diseases, we will not be able to control in our cold winter the same as we can in the summer with the heat, with the virus. It is really going to be important. The steps we take today will help us in the winter. So we will be, in addition to looking at plans for our backup hospitals and ventilators and working with business to keep them open, we will be dealing with educating our community to wear masks, to socially distance.
Thanks to Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall-Long and our Nick Schellino for joining us on The Green this week. We wrap up the show next with Arts Playlist and more on how the Milton Theater is working to reconnect with its audience after recently emerging from its COVID-19 shutdown. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Museums, theaters, and other arts institutions across the first state have been closed since the start of the coronavirus pandemic in mid-March. But as Delaware moves from Phase 1 to Phase 2 of its reopening plan, a number of them are starting to welcome visitors back through their doors. That includes the Milton Theater. Its executive director, Fred Munzert, says 60,000 people came to an estimated 400 events at the 110-year-old venue in 2019. And in this week's Arts Playlist, he talks to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about trying to revive that business and recover from the impact of COVID-19.
You had a soft opening last week. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Sure, we did, and it really went well. There's kind of two sides to the story. Some people are still hesitant and kind of waiting to see, and others have been ready to go. And what we found overwhelmingly for our folks is that they were ready to go. They wanted to come out, see each other from a distance, of course, and wearing a mask, of course. But people have been super comfortable and super supportive. We went into last week with the events mostly sold out, of course, sold out for us being, you know, a little less than 30% capacity and people social distance throughout the venue. So it was challenging, but a great week.
You know, I've been in the Milton Theater, and many of our listeners probably have as well, so I know how you guys are laid out. Talk about how you handled the reopening after being shuttered for so many weeks and months, and the 30% capacity. Are you doing, like, every other seat, every second seat? How are you handling that?
Yeah, we started by handling each party individually and just doing orders over the phone, and then we open it back up to the website once we got a hang of it. Like everybody, this is all new and has been new to all of us. So we're all figuring it out together. Our folks love to buy online, so we were happy to be able to open that up so they could do that. We basically are having parties sit together and then leaving about 6 feet in between each party, each household that comes and has enjoyed the shows and events together. Folks have been super comfortable with that. We have social distance marking going into the theater and as you walk throughout the theater so people could kind of maneuver carefully. And our capacity is almost 300. So when you go to 30%, it feels like it's kind of open. So, you know, everyone felt really comfortable with it because 30% of that, you know, you feel like it's kind of empty, but you know you're with everybody. So it was still a time to celebrate.
How are you handling the food and drink?
So we actually developed an online app that folks can sit in their seat and order just like you would for takeout at a restaurant or otherwise, and then just pick it up at a takeout location. So it seemed to have worked really well. You know, people that are used to apps and have been used to ordering out through this pandemic are pretty comfortable with just plugging in their information and paying where they are and then popping up there and grabbing it. And it really made it easy on our service staff. We did cut our menu back to make it simpler and just have fewer offerings, but as many as we could.
All right, let's just remind people we're talking to the director of the Milton Theater. It's right in the center of Milton, if you're not familiar. Fred Munzert on the line with me. Okay, so you did a soft reopening last week. What were the shows last week?
So we had 2 days of movies. We showed a film that was geared toward families and children one day. We showed a film that was more edgy and kind of action film. Then we had a stand-up comedy night and also a night of drag. And again, we felt people wanted more of the live entertainment than the movies, although the movies did go well. I think people have been sitting watching movies for a few months, so they were like, they wanted live people involved up there. And we were able to social distance the actors backstage using individual microphones and things like that, you know, only having 2 to 3 performers per night so they can social distance backstage and on stage.
Fred, I don't want to make this a negative story by any means, but how has the COVID-19 pandemic played a role financially for the Milton Theater?
Well, I don't think there's any other way to say it except devastating. We, you know, last year we saw 60,000 people through our doors with almost 400 events. We came into 2020 in January and February with almost every event sold out. So we just really were seeing a tremendous, tremendous time. And to come to March 13th, which was the day we kind of ground to a screeching halt, and then to cancel almost 6 months of events was terrifying, devastating. You know, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars in lost revenue, well into six figures of refunded tickets. It's been challenging. And a lot of the acts that we have, as people may or may not know, are national acts. And we just can't support those national acts on a limited capacity. So we kind of wiped out everything through September 1st and then focused on local, regional people that could drive, that didn't have to stay overnight. I'm talking about the acts now, and could come in and kind of do a shared profit where we kind of split the profits of the night between the house and the act coming through. Extremely challenging when we were used to the other setting, but we're finding our way. I've said from the beginning, I said this in 2008 when we went through the same thing, if the artist can't be creative, who can? And that's really how we approach it. Let's be creative. Let's find a way. Let's forge our way through it. And we're still here, and we're reopening.
Yeah, with all that said, not to mention the people that come into Milton may go out to dinner before coming to a show at the Milton Theater. All that revenue has been lost.
It's true. You know, 6 years ago when we came here, most of the storefronts were actually shuttered. And as the theater opened up and we saw people coming into town, we watched as those businesses opened. And we've heard feedback from all of them, and they've all said to us, please don't go anywhere. And they, as well as the community, have been very generous. We've had many people come and give cash donations. We had multiple people donate the checks that they got from the federal government right to the theater saying, we can't come back from this and you not be open, and we need you to survive this. And we have worked very hard to make sure that that happens. And I think our first week showed that we're here to stay, and we're going to stay here in the game and provide entertainment for people. People love art. Art is healing. It, you know, you laugh, you cry, you share in community with it. And I think it's one of the first things to come back and be positive. And after every major event in our country, art has always been one of the first things to rebound very quickly because people just want that relief.
I couldn't have said it better myself. You have been at the Milton Theater. I can't believe it's been 6 years already.
I can't either.
Give people some background about yourself and tell people about the Milton Theater who might not know that the Milton Theater is even there.
Yeah, I'm 40 plus years in this industry. I'm terrified to say that. So I started when I was 1 year old about. you know, I know. I can't believe it's been that long, but this has been my life work and my life passion, and I have seen the ups and downs through those years of many, many times and tragedies and great times as well. And so I just was pleased to come here and be a part of this. I'm born and raised in Delaware. This has been my home most of my life. I came to Milton Theater because when I saw it as an empty shell and boarded up, I just was completely drawn to it, and it had such great character, and the town and the folks in this town were just phenomenal. And I really wanted to be a part of it. And it's really been a great run. This theater, over 110 years old, has seen a lot. It's been flooded. It's been burned twice. It's been shuttered for years and keeps coming back. And once again, now, you know, from a pandemic, the Milton Theater will rise from the ashes, so to speak, and still be part of inspiring the community. And our community come from up to 2 hours away, one way with us as a primary destination. We have folks come from all over the region to come and enjoy shows and enjoy this beautiful town and the beaches here in the area.
Well, I so like your positivity, Fred. We're talking to Fred Munzert, the director of the Milton Theater. Okay, so soft opening last week. What happens now?
We have a lot of shows that we have planned. Our website, miltontheater.com, is the best place to see the most recent updates because we're really trying to get our footing. We don't have, you know, planned way in advance. We used to have up to 9 months out, but check each week on the Milton Theater website, and you're going to see lots of great offerings. In addition to indoors, we have a beautiful outdoor space, and we had a great outdoor event last week with folks sitting at picnic benches and in Adirondacks, and they brought their own chairs, and we sat and listened to music and had a beer and a glass of wine on the river here. So lots of great things that we're looking to be creative and put out there, and also our kids program that we're hoping to bring back as we just got the word that summer camps can come back this year.
Yeah, you guys do a lot of educational stuff with the children in the community. Talk about that a little bit.
We do. We went online right away, and our kids, our families were really thankful because they had something to do and something to look forward to each week. But we're really grateful to be able to do it in person again, starting in a few weeks once we get into phase two. And we have summer camps. We have year-round programs, all based on musical theater production. So it's acting, singing, and dancing. And we typically are sold out for all of those programs. We're super excited. And again, watch the website, miltontheater.com. Just click on the kids link at the top, and you'll see any kind of events, films, or live shows, and even all the educational programs on one page for kids and families.
Thanks to Milton Theater Executive Director Fred Munzert and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.